Book 3 of Savitri is central. And it's central in every respect. It's also the most difficult book. It's the most difficult book because it is the most complete. Everything is there, and in my view, this book alone could stand by itself and does stand by itself. So, for example, if you just to take a very mundane example, if we turn back to the end of the previous book, and we read these lines, we find that in book two, he has scaled the heights of mind, manifest mind, spiritual mind, and has entered into the absolute divine bliss and knowledge. And he has taken up the reins of cosmic force. And he has scanned the secrets of the overmind and born the rapture of the oversoul, and so on. And then when we start this book, we begin with all is too little. All is too little that the world can give. Its power and knowledge are the gifts of time and cannot fill the spirit's sacred thirst. The presence was lost by which all things have charm. The glory lacked of which they are dim signs. The world lived on, made empty of its cause, like love when the beloved's face is gone. The labor to know seemed a vain strife of mind. All knowledge ended in the unknowable. A cave of darkness guards the eternal light. A silence settled on his striving heart. So the theme of this book, book three, the adoration of the Divine Mother, is the theme of sacrifice. And if we look at the structure of the two previous books and compared to this one, we see in the first one, we have seen the mythical structure. He has described the entry into the darkness of the divine and the presence of the divine in the darkness and the evolving process of the world. In book two, he has displayed the horizontal structure of the dualities, all of the dualities that constitute manifest existence, all the way to the top. All of the planes are characterized by dualities, and he has focused several cantos on the involvement of consciousness in the physical plane, and then the vital plane, and the mental plane, and all the way up to the spiritual plane, all characterized by dualities. In the third book, the structure is the structure of yoga, the structure of the ascent of the sacrifice, as he calls it in the synthesis of yoga, the doing of transformation is the theme of book three. It's yoga. If we looked at it in the historical perspective that Vladimir put up a while ago, we might think of it as three ages of the descent of knowledge from the mythical to the, from the Vedic to the Upanishadic to the yogic. This book is about experience. It's about the experience of Sri Aurobindo in the yoga of transformation. How does it work? What exactly is the experience of transformation? And what is its result? This is quite a different structure. In literary criticism, we have a debate that always goes on between structure and nature. The nature of the thing itself and the structure of the thing, which we understand by analyzing it and comparing it and examining it. And then we tend to describe structure almost as if it were the thing itself. In Savitri, we can't make that mistake, because mantric poetry about yoga is the force of yoga itself. So one is tempted to just plunge into the nature of the thing itself, because we know from experience that this mantric poetry has the power to convey the experience of sacrifice and of yoga. But that's not our approach in this series of lectures. We are examining the structure. We are looking for patterns that we can derive by compressing the book into recognizable patterns, meanings, structures, themes, so that we acquire a familiarity with the book as a whole and with the entire work. So we're compressing each book into one lecture. But still, it's necessary to read the lines to have some sense of what the essence of this structure is. What is the nature of the structure? So we can move back and forth between nature and structure. The human mind is quite capable of doing that. But it's important to recognize that that's what we're doing. And therefore, we are not going to have the full benefit of the mantric power. And we're not going to experience fully the nature of the reality about which we are hearing. But we will catch something of it so that we have an impression of what it is, this thing that I have just identified as the structure of yogic sacrifice. There's a fairly close relationship between this knowledge and what we were speaking of on Monday night in the philosophy of evolution, where we explored Sri Aurobindo's definition of the Buddhistic process of using the intelligent will to purify mind and life and body, and to take a position of detachment with regard to rational processes and sensations and perceptions, in order to allow a higher power of consciousness to descend. So he describes this process continually in all of his books. In this canto, he brings that process to its absolute, profoundest pitch of experience. And so in this first book, in this first canto of the book, he positions the effort with respect to the world of experience in this way. He begins by saying, all is too little that the world can give. And he turned to the ineffable's timeless call. The timeless call of that which is ineffable, undescribable. And how does that feel? How does it work to actually do that? We turn over just two pages, we get this description, which is quite vivid. The whole canto is just a description of this turning to the ineffable's call. There is nothing else in this canto. In an abysmal lapse of all things built, transcending every perishable support, and joining at last its mighty origin, the separate self must melt or be reborn into a truth beyond the mind's appeal. All glory of outline, sweetness of harmony, rejected like a grace of trivial notes, expunged from being's silence, nude, austere, died into a fine and blissful nothingness. The demiurges lost their names and forms. The great schemed worlds that they had planned and wrought passed, taken and abolished, one by one. The universe removed its colored veil. And at the unimaginable end of the huge riddle of created things appeared the far-seeing Godhead of the whole, his feet firm based on life's stupendous wings, omnipotent, a lonely seer of time, inward, inscrutable, with diamond gaze. Hiranyagarbha, I suppose. So standing before that supreme, finality, that supreme finality of all this, all from his puissance born was now undone. Nothing remained, the cosmic mind conceives. Eternity prepared to fade and seemed a hue and imposition on the void. Space was the fluttering of a dream that sank before its ending into nothing's deeps. The spirit that dies not, and the Godhead's self, seemed myths projected from the unknowable. From it all sprang, in it is called to cease. But what that was, no thought nor sight could tell. Only a formless form of self was left. A tenuous ghost of something that had been, the last experience of a lapsing wave before it sinks into a bornless sea, as if it kept, even on the brink of naught, its bare feeling of the ocean whence it came. A vastness brooded, free from sense of space, an everlastingness cut off from time, a strange, sublime, inalterable peace, silent, rejected from it world and soul. A stark, companionless reality. Answered at last to his soul's passionate search. Passionless, wordless, absorbed in its fathomless hush, keeping the mystery none would ever pierce, it brooded, inscrutable and intangible, facing him with its dumb, tremendous calm. It had no kinship with the universe. There was no act, no movement in its vast. Life's question, met by its silence, died on her lips. The world's effort ceased, convicted of ignorance, finding no sanction of supernal light. There was no mind there, with its need to know. There was no heart there with its need to love. All person perished in its namelessness. There was no second. It had no partner or peer. Only itself was real to itself. A pure existence, safe from thought and mood. A consciousness of unshared immortal bliss, it dwelt aloof in its bare infinite, one and unique, unutterably soul, a being formless, featureless, and mute, that knew itself by its own timeless self, aware forever in its motionless depths, uncreating, uncreated, and unborn. The one by whom all live, who lives by none. An immeasurable, luminous secrecy, guarded by the veils of the unmanifest, above the changing cosmic interlude, abode supreme. Immutably the same, a silent cause, occult, impenetrable, infinite, eternal, unthinkable, alone. And so the adoration of the Divine Mother begins with this. This is yoga. A stillness absolute. Incommunicable meets the sheer self-discovery of the soul. A wall of stillness shuts it from the world. A gulf of stillness swallows up the sense and makes unreal all that mind has known. All that the laboring senses still would weave, prolonging an imaged unreality. Self's vast spiritual silence occupies space. The Yoga of Savitri, which we will come to in a couple of weeks, in that book, in several of the cantos of that book, he repeats exactly the same idea. And each of the four cantos of this book, he repeats that same idea. So I'm going through the four examples in the four cantos of this book. So what follows in the next canto is this. There is a zero sign of the Supreme. Nature left nude and still uncovers God. But in her grandiose nothingness, all is there. This is the Buddhistic idea, by the way. The essential Buddhistic idea. In Mahayana, even the next part. When her strong garbs are torn away from us, the soul's ignorance is slain, but not the soul. The zero covers an immortal face. A high and blank negation is not all. A huge extinction is not God's last word. Life's ultimate sense, the close of being's course, the meaning of this great mysterious world. In absolute silence sleeps an absolute power. Awaking, it can wake the trance-bound soul. And in the ray, reveal the parent sun. It can make the world a vessel of spirit's force. It can fashion in the clay God's perfect shape. To free the self is but one radiant pace, but necessary. Here to fulfill himself was God's desire. Even while he stood on being's naked edge, and all the passion and seeking of his soul faced their extinction in some featureless vast, the presence he yearned for suddenly drew close. A moment's sweetness of the all-beautiful canceled the vanity of the cosmic world. A nature throbbing with a heart divine was felt in the unconscious universe. It made the breath a happy mystery, a love that bore the cross of pain with joy. You eudaimonized the sorrow of the world. Made happy the weight of long unending time, the secret caught of God's felicity. Affirming in life a hidden ecstasy, it held the spirit to its miraculous course, carrying immortal values to the hours. It justified the labor of the sons, for one was there, supreme, behind the God. Which God is he referring to? That God of absolute, luminous emptiness. Perhaps that being, that self, that supreme self. A mother might brooded on the world. A consciousness revealed its marvelous front, transcending all that is, denying none. Imperishable above our fallen heads, he felt a rapturous and unstumbling force. The undying truth appeared, the enduring power of all that here is made and then destroyed. The mother of all Godheads and all strengths, who, mediatrix, binds earth to the supreme. The hidden word was found, the long-sought clue. Revealed was the meaning of our spirit's birth, condemned to an imperfect body and mind, in the inconscience of material things and the indignity of mortal life. A heart was felt in the spaces wide and bare. A heart was felt in the spaces wide and bare. A burning love from white spiritual founts annulled the sorrow of the ignorant depths. Suffering was lost in her immortal smile. A life from beyond grew conqueror here of death. To err no more was natural to mind. Wrong could not come where all was light and love. The formless and the formed were joined in her. I maintain that that is exactly what Mahayana Buddhism is all about. When formlessness and form are realized to be one thing, one reality, one truth, emptiness and compassion. That is the ultimate realization possible to mind. Now, Sri Aurobindo will say, as he did about all the other planes that he ascended, that is not enough. But what I want us to recognize is that the path of yoga, the yoga of sacrifice and surrender, leads to the emptiness, and through the emptiness to the absolute divine bliss. Even after this realization, when we go to book three, canto three, sorry. A mightier task remained than all he had done. To that he turned, from which all being comes. A sign attending from the secrecy which knows the truth ungrasped behind our thoughts and guards the world with its all-seeing gaze. In the unapproachable stillness of his soul, intense, one-pointed, monumental, lone, patient he sat, like an incarnate hope, motionless, on a pedestal of prayer, a strength he sought that was not yet on earth. Help from a power too great for mortal will, the light of a truth now only seen afar, a sanction from his high, omnipotent source. But from the appalling heights there stooped no voice. The timeless lids were closed. No opening came. A neutral, helpless void oppressed the years. Patient he sat. Like an incarnate hope. In the texture of our bound humanity, he felt the stark resistance, huge and dumb, of our inconscient and unseeing base. The stubborn, mute rejection in life's depths. So we'll stay in this canto a little while longer. There is a description here of the silence, which is quite beautiful, and a beautiful description of what follows the silence. As one who sets his sail towards mysteried shores, driven through huge oceans by the breath of God, the fathomless below, the unknown around, his soul abandoned the blind starfield space. Afar from all that makes the measured world, plunging to hidden eternities, it withdrew back from mind's foaming surface to the vasts, voiceless within us, in omniscient sleep. Omniscient sleep, trance-bound soul. Above the imperfect reach of word and thought, beyond the sight that seeks support of form, lost in deep tracts of superconscient light, or voyaging in blank, featureless nothingness, soul in the trackless, incommensurable. Or past, not self, and self, and selflessness, transgressing the dream shores of conscious mind, he reached at last his sempiternal base. On sorrowless heights, no winging cry disturbs. Pure and untouched, above this mortal play is spread the spirit's hushed, immobile air. There no beginning is, and there no end. Do we dare? Do we dare? There is the stable force of all that moves. Form and formlessness are one there. There is the stable force of all that moves. There the aeonic laborer is at rest. There turns no keyed creation in the void. No giant mechanism watched by a soul. There creaks no fate-turned huge machinery. The marriage of evil with good within one breast, the clash of strife in the very clasp of love, the dangerous pain of life's experiment. None of that. The stillness. Sri Aurobindo often uses the phrase in his books, "For those who seek the silence," capital S, dot, 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 and at the end of one chapter of the synthesis of yoga, he says, "We shall know that tat as the silence." But what he means by that is all of this. He doesn't just mean that the mosquitoes aren't buzzing in our ear. This silence is something else. It's a force that's all-pervading and nowhere. surprise. Then suddenly there came a downward look, as if a sea exploring its own depths, a living oneness widened at its core and joined him to unnumbered multitudes, a bliss, a light, a power, a flame-white love, caught all into a soul immense embrace. Existence found its truth on oneness's breast, and each became the self and space of all. The great world rhythms were heartbeats of one soul. To feel was a flame discovery of God. So in that emptiness, there is still feeling, and there is still everybody, and everybody and every feeling are that. All mind was a single harp of many strings. All life a song of many meeting lives. For worlds were many, but the self was one. Then, I think I'll skip Book 4, because Book 4 is a continuous, beautiful description of what life is like to that consciousness. It's the fully emerged, realized soul experience of sensation, perception, thought, person, personality, higher mind, over mind, super mind, everything in just a continuous pulsation of beauty and power and truth. So Canto 3 of Book 3 is that. It's what our life should be like. Then, in Canto 4, called The Vision and the Boon, we have the fullest and most personal expression of Sri Aurobindo's yoga that Sri Aurobindo has written. You can hear his voice speaking in this canto, and you know that that is exactly what he did and what he meant and what he wants us to feel and see. We can't do that in this context, but this is an experience which is accessible, and this canto, especially as at the coming at the end of the book, after the other three cantos, if read rhythmically and powerfully, is absolutely unbelievable. And here, Sri Aurobindo employs that technique that we spoke about at length in the first series, where he uses the epic form of voice to express experience, his experience. So here, for the first time, practically, in Savitri, we get this technique. And from here forward, throughout the book, we get this technique repeatedly. We've had some, perhaps a few moments of it, but here the technique is fully employed. And so we hear speaking to us the voice of experience, in quotation marks. And we have the culmination of the what I call the yoga of Aswapati. The Aswapati yoga cycle is culminated in this canto. All of Sri Aurobindo's yoga is culminated in this canto. The three cantos of Book 1, all of Book 2 and Book 3 constitute what I call the Aswapati yoga cycle. And Book 2 can be left out of that completely, and still the whole cycle is present. So the three cantos of Book 1 and the four cantos of Book 3 constitute one continuous yogic movement, which culminates here. And it comes exactly in the middle of the book. There are 720 pages or so, and this comes on page 350 or so when it ends. And the context here is that in the previous two cantos, Aswapati has realized the Divine Mother in himself. And I'll just read that part. Amid the lifeless silence of the void, in a solitude and an immensity, a sound came quivering like a loved footfall, heard in the listening spaces of the soul. A touch perturbed his fibers with delight. An influence had appeared, had approached the mortal range. A boundless heart was near his longing heart. A mystic form enveloped his earthly shape. All at her contact broke from silence's seal. Silence's seal. Okay, the Mahamudra. All at her contact broke from silence's seal. Spirit and body thrilled, identified, linked in the grasp of an unspoken joy, mind, members, life were merged in ecstasy. Intoxicated as with nectarous rain, his nature's passioning stretches flowed to her, flashing with lightnings, mad with luminous wine. All was a limitless sea that heaved to the moon. A divinizing stream possessed his veins. His body's cells awoke to spirit sense. Each nerve became a burning thread of joy. Tissue and flesh partook beatitude. The one he worshipped was within him now. That is the culmination of Mahamudra and Lakshmi Tantra, the integral divine yoga. The synthetic combined integral yoga. Mahamudra and Lakshmi Tantra. For those who know those other traditions, that might mean something. It's not important. It's just an observation. And then, with her in him, identified with the Supreme, Sri Shakti, she speaks. She speaks to Sri Aurobindo. This is very tangible stuff. This is what he faced. This is what he heard. O son of strength, who climbest creation's peaks, no soul is thy companion in the light. Alone thou standest at the eternal doors. What thou hast won is thine, but ask no more. O spirit aspiring in an ignorant frame, O voice arisen from the inconscience world, how shalt thou speak for men whose hearts are dumb? Make purblind earth the soul's seer vision's home, or lighten the burden of the senseless globe. I am the mystery beyond reach of mind. I am the goal of the travail of the suns. My fire and sweetness are the cause of life, but too immense my danger and my joy. Awake not the immeasurable descent. Speak not my secret name to hostile time. Man is too weak to bear the infinite's weight. Truth born too soon might break the imperfect earth. Leave the all-seeing power to hew its way. In thy single vast achievement reign apart, helping the world with thy great lonely days. I ask thee not to merge thy heart of flame in the immobile's wide, uncaring bliss, turned from the fruitless motion of the years, deserting the fierce labor of the worlds, aloof from beings, lost in the alone. Not that. How shall thy mighty spirit brook repose while death is still unconquered on the earth and time a field of suffering and pain? This is the Bodhisattva ideal. Stay and alleviate suffering and pain, but don't ask that suffering and pain itself should be deleted from the scene by the divine force, because the divine force is too great for that. Suffering and pain have a purpose and a time and a right to exist. That's what he keeps hearing. And even when we get to the end of the book and Savitri is there in death, with death, facing death, with all the power of the Divine Mother in her, she hears exactly the same thing. This is the epic of the yoga of transformation. This is where the crux of the problem lies. Absolute deliverance and divine bliss are possible and can be attained by numerous different paths of approach, including this one. And when it is attained, there is the problem. That solution is a solution, but it's also the problem. Because that formless form is here now. It's the essence of all of this. Formlessness and form are already united. And it can be realized yogically. And that's a release from suffering. And it's necessary to go there spiritually. But before she finishes, before the Supreme Divine Mother finishes this speech, she says something which is so characteristic of Sri Aurobindo that I want to read it, and then we'll stop for tonight. An inert soul and a somnambulist force have made a world estranged from life and thought. The dragon of the dark foundations keeps unalterable the law of chance and death. On his long way through time and circumstance, the gray-hued, riddling, nether shadow sphinx, her dreadful paws upon the swallowing sands, awaits him armed with the soul-slaying word. Across his path sits the dim camp of night. His day is a moment in perpetual time. He is the prey of the minutes and the hours. So one of the other structures that we find in Sri Aurobindo's poetry is that he articulates the problem as a part of this sacrifice. A part of the sacrifice is to surrender to the reality. And then, in that surrender and in that call, there descends the potential of change. The force of change. that which is to be realized. So one of the themes that runs through this canto, and this book, is the theme of sacrifice and that for which the sacrifice is made. The sacrifice of yoga is made to penetrate this paradox of existence, to come to terms with the unity of formlessness and form, and the dualities that come from that unity. And coming to terms with that means surrendering to the possibility that that reality itself can change. That's Sri Aurobindo's call. And so she says to him, in response to this call, adept of the self-born, unfailing line, leave not the light to die the ages bore. Help still humanity's blind and suffering life. Obey thy spirit's wide, omnipotent urge, a witness to God's parley with the night. It leaned compassionate from immortal calm and housed desire, the troubled seed of things. His spirit did that originally. It leaned originally from immortal calm, out of compassion, and housed desire, the troubled seed of things. Assent to thy high self, create, endure. What did Sri Aurobindo do? That is exactly what he did. Assent to thy high self, create, endure. Cease not from knowledge, let thy toil be vast. No more can earthly limits pen thy force. Equal thy work with long, unending times. Traveler upon the bare, eternal heights, tread still the difficult and dateless path, joining the cycles with its austere curve measured for man by the initiate gods. My light shall be in thee, my strength thy force. Let not the impatient Titan drive thy heart. Ask not the imperfect fruit, the partial prize. Only one boon, to greaten thy spirit, demand. Only one joy, to raise thy kind, desire. Above blind fate and the antagonist powers, moveless there stands a high, unchanging will. To its omnipotence leave thy work's result. All things shall change. in God's transfiguring hour. So he gets the answer to the question that he asks, but he also gets a wait and see message. Do everything that you can, create, endure, lift up the race. But this transformation for which you ask, leave it to the Supreme and time. Time is the creatrix. And so, he says, in the end, surrender was his only strength. But that surrender is pretty strong, because he is surrendering to that Supreme energy to do that change, to be the instrument of that change. That is the thing to which he surrenders. And I can just skip to that line, perhaps. No, I didn't mark it. There's a beautiful passage that follows this, which is often trivialized, and it's extremely difficult to read and understand, and that's why it's often trivialized. Maybe some other time we can take that on, but he does make one more, he appeals once more to the divine within him for the descent of Savitri. The force of transformation, a special force of transformation at this moment on earth to help hasten that event. And she assents to his request. And everything from there on follows from that. Savitri descends. A force of the divine to do the work of, to hasten the work of transformation. And in that passage, which we're not reading, Sri Aurobindo and the mother speak loud and clear about what that moment, that particular call and that particular response mean for the earth. The grace of Savitri, yes?
So which line is it?
It's not just a line, it's about 80 lines or so.
Could you tell us which lines?
So, oh, sure.
We have something to do for
week? Yeah, yes, please read it for next week. It's page 345 to 346. He speaks and she speaks. In quotation marks. Which mean, according to his theory of poetry, that he is allowing the truth itself to speak. And so we know that in this reading of Savitri, this is the drama of the yoga of Sri Aurobindo. And Sri Aurobindo invoked the power of the word as a bringer of force for transformation. His aspiration was for the descent of the power of the word for the transformation. O truth defended in thy secret son, voice of her mighty musings in shut heavens, on things withdrawn within her luminous depths, O wisdom splendor, mother of the universe, creatrix, the eternal's artist bride, linger not long with thy transmuting hand pressed vainly on one golden bar of time, as if time dare not open its heart to God. O radiant fountain of the world's delight, world free and unattainable above, O bliss, whoever dwellest deep hid within, while men seek the outside and never find, mystery and muse with hieratic tongue, incarnate the white passion of thy force, mission to earth some living form of thee. Let a great word be spoken from the heights, and one great act unlock the doors of fate. If anybody wants a copy of the last talks, chapter 8 is all about this. And the book is there, it's 250 rupees, which can be done by account if you want to transfer it. Or brought, you can take the book and give it sometime if you want. Anyway, chapter 8 is about this part of Savitri, 8 and 9.
Wow.